Plants can be medicine, and there's a spectrum of plants you can use for health, including plant-based foods, herbs, spices, and herbal supplements. In today's episode, we'll be talking about herbs and which ones you should consider taking. Hello, and welcome to The Whole Health Cure, a space for trustworthy, science-based information from the world's leading experts on how you can live healthier and longer through the way you move, think, and recover. I'm your host, Dr. Sharon Berquist, a physician, scientist, and lifestyle as medicine pioneer. And I'm thrilled today to be joined by Dr. Bill Rawls. Dr. Rawls is a fourth-generation physician, leading expert in integrative health, and medical director of VitalPlan, a holistic health and herbal supplement company in Raleigh, North Carolina. He has extensively studied the science behind herbal therapies and their role in restoring cellular wellness. He is the author of the bestseller, The Cellular Wellness Solution, Tap into Your Full Health Potential with Science-Backed Power of Herbs. Bill, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's a real pleasure.
Bill, I've long been a proponent of plant-based foods, plant-based diets, because of the value of plant chemicals, the phytochemicals, which do so much for our health. And I like to think of the interventions that we do, whatever we recommend for our patients, a mechanistic level, like what are we doing? Why are we making a recommendation? And I want to start by asking you to talk about wellness at a cellular level. So what are we accomplishing at the cellular level when we're trying to get better?
Yeah, we don't normally think of ourselves that way. When we look in the mirror, we see the whole person, all of us. But when, no matter what type of life you're talking about, the smallest functional unit is a living cell. So we are a composite made up of literally trillions and trillions of cells. Everything that happens in the body is a function of cells, whether that's your heart beating or a thyroid hormone being produced or your bones and cartilage being rearranged to stay healthy. It's all done by cells. Absolutely everything is cellular. So your health is very much a function of the health of the collective complement of all the cells in your body.
And what makes you lose health? Like at a cellular level, what is happening as people start to develop symptoms, as illness starts to come on?
Yeah, it's an interesting way to look at symptoms. So again, if we feel well, it's because all of our cells are functioning well. All of our cells are healthy and all of our cells are coordinated, you know? So when we talk about hormones and neurotransmitters and all of this, what that is just cells talking to other cells to coordinate all those functions so we can work as a unit. So if you have symptoms, any type of symptom, that's a function of cells being stressed in the body. So it's pretty simple, really. I mean, you block a coronary artery in your heart and that prevents your cells, those heart cells, from getting the blood and nutrients they need. So they start to suffer. They become stressed. And when cells in the body are stressed, so whether you're talking about heart symptoms or a sore knee or a twisted ankle, headaches, anything, it's a function of cells being stressed. So when cells are stressed, two things happen. So there's two parts to that symptom. One, cells release substances that activate nerves that tell the brain something's wrong. So we feel it as pain or discomfort. You get chest pain when that coronary artery is blocked and those cells are stressed. But also, they lose function. So the cells aren't able to do their job. They're not able to do what they need to do. So we start losing that function. And if it's heart or brain cells, that's really vital. A little bit less so, like if you just twist your ankle or something like that. But either way, so part of that symptom is not only feeling pain, but also losing functions in your body. So our body is always talking to us. It's telling us what is going on. Our cells are speaking to us constantly.
And when cells lose function, like you said, of course, diseases like even cancer can happen. And there's a lot of excitement around cell-based therapies, right? Immunotherapy, a lot of cell-targeted therapies. And these are interventions that you get typically in a medical facility, but there are ways that you can make your cells healthier without those interventions. So can you talk a little bit about what are cell-based ways of improving health that we can do through lifestyle and specifically, of course, through plants.
Right. Well, yes, there certainly we're exploring a lot of different kinds of interventions, but there are limitations with each one of those things. So when you talk about, well, if your cells are stressed, if you are having symptoms, what can you do to reverse that? So if it's something like a blocked coronary artery, just putting in a stent or opening up that blockage so cells start getting the nutrients and oxygen they need, that's pretty obvious, and that will relieve that symptom pretty darn fast. But when we talk about symptoms of chronic illness, that people feel fatigue, they feel terrible all over, they've got broad spectrum joint discomfort and neurological symptoms and so many different kinds of symptoms all at once, it suggests that there's a lot of stress going on in the body. So it's not quite as direct as a blocked coronary artery or even a twisted ankle. You know, it's more diffuse, but you can still ask that question, what's causing the stress? So for any cell in the body to be healthy, it needs basically five different things that are really important. So it needs the right nutrients. It needs not only oxygen, but carbohydrates and fat to generate energy and other materials to do its work. Like a thyroid cell needs iodine to make thyroid hormone. So we need raw materials that come from our food. So nutrients are really important. Cells need a clean environment. So in our world today, we are bombarded with toxins like we've never been exposed to before that are an unnatural part of our ecosystem that are coming from petroleum and burning coal and plastic manufacture and herbicides. And these things are coming to us in our food, our water, our air, through skin products. Those things do harm by inhibiting cellular functions. They're foreign to our cells. So our cells are burdened. They're slowed down when they're exposed to those things. Third category is our cells need downtime. Now, heart cells rest in between the beats, but most of our other cells need time to resort themselves, to get rid of worn out proteins and basically rebuild. A lot of that happens when we are sleeping at night. So we need to be stressed. We need motivation to get up off the couch and get us going, but we need downtime through the day and also especially at night for sleep. So that's really important. So that's three categories. Fourth, I put under physical factors. So we talk about exercise, and there are obviously a lot of benefits we could list for exercise, but the main thing that exercise does is move blood. So when we are out exercising, we increase our heart rate, we dilate blood vessels, and that allows fluid to flow into the space around our cells, which enhances nutrient delivery, oxygen delivery, and helps wash away buildup of toxic waste and toxic substances. You know, cells are toxic. Detoxification isn't something that happens occasionally. Your cells are constantly trying to purge any toxins. So that has to be done. And under that physical category, I also put trauma. Obviously, trauma can damage cells, and that can be a factor. Fifth category is just a wide open category that affects us in so many ways, and that is microbes, invasive microbes. Our cells' arch enemy is microbes. And when we get an infection, what those microbes, viruses, bacteria, protozoa, whatever, are doing is invading our cells because our cells are basically food, what they need to replicate. So those five categories of things are things that cells need. They need protection from microbes, good nutrients, a clean environment, regular exercise, downtime, sleep. And those things are so obvious, and those are needs for every single cell. So when you look at that model, it's really powerful because no matter what disease you're trying to eliminate or reduce the risk of, those factors will reduce the risk of that illness and all other illnesses, including cancer, which is really remarkable just to have an equation that is that simple. So that's where I put a lot of effort of my work of helping people understand how this can be so powerful.
Yeah, and I want to reiterate a point that you just made, that when you're making the cells healthier, you're improving a symptom which is different than trying to treat a diagnosis. I think that's a really important distinction, right? Yep. Because making those cells healthier, even without a diagnosis, can make a symptom improve, and it can make multiple symptoms improve, right? As you're saying that these are the five things that cells need. These are the common pathways, if you will, to get a wide range of symptoms to improve.
Yeah, I agree. I don't really think in terms of diagnosis like I used to. You know, I think it's still a useful concept. But what a diagnosis does is define the treatment protocol. And for acute illnesses like a broken leg or a blocked coronary vessel, something that there's one specific cause, that concept of diagnosis is very useful. It can really direct therapy. But when you move into chronic illnesses that are multifactorial, there are lots of causes that have been adding up for a long time. That idea of diagnosis doesn't work as well. And as we find, diagnoses run together. There are so many different diagnoses. And when we look at drug treatment protocols for chronic illness, they're not designed to affect cellular stress. They're designed to block manifestations of illness, block symptoms, slow down processes. But because they don't address cellular stress, people typically don't get well. They just end up in a state of managed illness. So when I work with patients, typically the question I'm asking is, why did you become ill in the first place? What kind of factors in your life added up? And genetics is a factor, but I think we put too much weight there. I think of genetics as, you know, it's kind of the hand that life deals you, and how you play that hand really matters. And it's these environmental factors, of which we have so much control, are bigger factors in whether someone will develop chronic illness. So if we can look and say, well, how do we reduce those factors? How do we enhance that state of creating an environment where cells can recover from being stressed? Then people can get well no matter what the diagnosis.
And herbs being plants, so herbs are not nutrients, but they have these powerful phytochemicals. How do they fit in your mind in this bigger picture of cellular wellness?
Yeah, it took me a long time to kind of come around to this. And I had an event in my life that I struggled with a chronic illness, and conventional therapies really provided no benefit. I came around to this other model, but even better lifestyle didn't quite get me where I wanted to be. I ended up using an herbal protocol that helped me get back to where I needed to be as far as a state of wellness. And I've been taking herbs continually now for 15 years, not to treat a problem like they're often used for, but to maintain wellness, which is a really different way of thinking about herbs. When I was first studying herbs, I looked at all the herbal traditions, traditional Chinese medicine, Ayurvedic medicine, and I read very deeply and studied all of these things. And I found that they were valuable, but they didn't quite take me to where I needed to be, which was more of a Western science approach. So all of those things were observational. And again, the observations that were made were very valuable, but they really didn't have any ability to understand what was happening at the cellular and biochemical level. So in my journey, and fortunately because of the internet, there's been so much research on how the chemistry of the plants affects our physiology over the past couple of decades. It's just extraordinary. But basically what it boils down to is plants are multicellular organisms just like we are. And plant cells are hammered with the same kinds of stress factors that we are: free radicals, radiation, abnormal nutrients, and microbes of every variety. So plants create this chemical defense system that's a little bit different for each plant depending on the stress factors in the plant's natural environment and how it is chosen to solve those things. So all plants are creating this robust spectrum of chemicals that we call phytochemicals. And plants have, that we define as herbs, are things that humans have been using in one way or another, either as food or medicine, for literally hundreds or even thousands of years. So we've selectively chosen the things that mesh well with our biochemistry. You know, it's like poison ivy has some wonderful protective and antimicrobial properties, but nobody would make the mistake of eating it as a medicine twice. But there are so many plants that have that effect of when we take them, they protect our cells. They have this broad spectrum protection against free radicals, toxic substances, and all these invasive microbes that we're exposed to. And that's true of every single herb. Plants also have chemical messengers that are like ours. You know, plants have to coordinate their cellular functions. So sometimes those things can have a drug-like effect. We know that there are certain plants that we can use as drugs to get an effect that we would look for, like we would find in a drug. Where I found most useful is plants, herbs that don't have drug-like effects, just have this balancing protective effect, so they can be taken every day. And wow, the results of doing that are just really extraordinary.
And Bill, that's such an important point to really talk through, because there's so many plant substances that we can consume, right? There's a variety of plant-based foods, then there are herbal types of plants. And within the spectrum of herbal, there are some, like you said, that you can take every day. And then there's some that are so potent that they are, well, not just like medicine, they're really the primary way we discover medications. Within the spectrum of food and herbs, how do you look at phytochemicals, the substances that these plants are making that are in foods, say blueberries, versus herbal options?
Yeah. The line is sometimes a little bit gray between what we would define as a food and what we would define as an herb. You know, there are a lot of wonderful foods that do have phytochemicals, broccoli and celery and blueberries, fruits and vegetables. Many of them are loaded with a wide spectrum of protective phytochemicals that are beneficial to us. And culinary herbs are herbs that happen to have a flavor that we'd like, so we often include them in our food. The biggest difference, though, in a plant that we cultivate for food and a plant that we cultivate to be an herb is what we're trying to get out of that plant. So all of our food plants are cultivated to produce calories selectively. That's why we grow them. And we've been doing that for so long that we have created plants that are favored for their calories at the reduction of the phytochemical concentration. So you have to think about it. The plant is producing these protective phytochemicals to protect itself from stress. So we are trying to grow our food plants in a stress-free environment so they'll produce lots of calories. We add in pesticides. We do it in a very controlled environment. Even if you're growing organic, you're trying not to stress that plant. You want it to grow so it will produce a lot of calories. So the fact that we've cultivated plants for calories and we grow them in controlled conditions that reduces stress means the phytochemical, the protective phytochemical concentration of our food plants is much, much less than in our herbs, which remain in a wild state. So it's interesting to think about it that way. But if you look at a wild blueberry, it's about half the size of a cultivated blueberry. So a cup of cultivated blueberries has about 27 grams of carbohydrate, where a cup of wild blueberries only has about 17 or 18 grams of carbohydrate. The phytochemical concentration, the protective chemicals in the wild blueberries, is just about double what you find in our food plants. So it really makes a case for why we should be supplementing with herbs in some capacity, whether you're taking herbs fresh in a wild state yourself and processing them, which isn't practical for the average person, or you're getting those chemical substances in supplements, which is more practical for most of us.
If a person is looking to incorporate more herbs, How would you recommend they get started?
Well, there's a lot of ways you can do it. And I do recommend eating more vegetables than anything else, because you do want to get all those great phytochemicals from all those things that I talked about. But the most practical way is doing supplements. There are different ways you can do supplements, and you do have to be somewhat aware of what's out there. So that's one of the things that I put in the book that I didn't find in other places. We're really helping people to make those kinds of choices of how herbs are actually created, how herbal products are created, but also what to look for. So many products are whole herb powders. If you're just getting capsules or even gummies, what you're getting is basically they take the plant and crush it up into a powder, and then they put that in a capsule or a gummy or whatever. You're getting a lot of the fiber of the plant. You're not getting that much of the phytochemistry. So most of your less expensive products really don't have that much. Some people are taking tinctures. So a better way to get your phytochemistry is in a tincture, which they take the plant, soak it in water and alcohol. And that's different. It's going to give a more robust concentration than if you're just doing a tea, because the alcohol pulls out other chemicals that water doesn't. So that's one way to get it. The disadvantage of the tinctures is you're getting alcohol. And also, a lot of herbs, a lot of your better medicinal herbs really have a strong bitter taste. The final way to do it, and what I use most often, are what we call standardized powdered extracts, that they take a tincture, spray it on a surface, dry off the water and alcohol, and just collect the powder. So it's just pure concentrated phytochemicals. So one of those capsules may equal couple of teaspoons or four or five capsules of the other preparations. So however you get them, though, they're really valuable. But the greater the concentration of phytochemicals that you mix in, the more benefit you're going to get.
How do we know how much we need, right? Because if a person is eating 30 plus plant varieties a week, kind of the benchmark for the microbiome, how do we know that's not enough? How do we know what is that amount that we're targeting, and how do we measure? Are there any objective ways to know where we're at?
Yeah, not as much as you would think, and I don't think it's as necessary as you might think either. We do want to control the doses of our drugs, because anything over a certain level can be poisonous. You know, you take two or three ibuprofen, it's fine. You take a whole bottle and it can make you really sick. So with this herbs and drugs are completely different. With our herbs, especially these what I call everyday herbs that you could take on an everyday basis, these herbs, the potential for toxicity is extremely low, and it's very hard to get too much. I remember we had some testing done on a particular extract that we were putting in our supplements, and the company that was providing it had done toxicology studies, and they found that the toxic dose for this particular extract for humans was 3,000 capsules a day. So it's really hard to get toxic with most of these things. And I think it depends on time and age. When we talk about cells, we need to protect our cells. What aging is loss of functional cells. So we hit peak cell count around age 20. At that point, our cells are new. We have 5 to 10 times more cells than we need. But after that, our cells gradually age. And that part of the aging is basically the run out of energy. They lose mitochondrial function. So not to go too deeply into that, but just think about your body as gradually losing cells. Professional athletes by age 40 are generally done, because they don't have half the cells that they did when they were age 20. They just don't have that same functional capacity. So as we age, we need to be taking care of our cells more and more. So as you go through life over 40, certainly by age 50 or 60, those herbs, though they're valuable throughout life, they're going to become even more valuable as you age. I take a pretty large consumption of herbs. And this was very contrary to how I was taught in medical school. It's like, you don't want to take any more drugs than you have to, and you want to take them in the lowest amount. So I was pretty careful about increasing the dose of the herbs, and I would start and stop, and finally found that I just felt so much better on the herbs. I made a decision over a decade ago that I was just going to keep taking them every day. And I take probably about, 6 to 8 different herbs in pretty significant concentrations every day of my life. And at age 65, things are normal. I mean, not only did I get all my health back, but things that I didn't expect. I was diagnosed with essential hypertension when I was in my 30s, and I never could tolerate any of the drugs. I had decided just to accept it. So after years of doing herbs, my blood pressure went back to normal. Here at age 65, my blood pressure is typically 115 over 75 at most any point in time. No drugs, just herbs. My cholesterol is lower than when I was in my 40s. My blood sugar is low. I don't really have any significant symptoms or any use for medications at this point. That may change with time. I haven't stopped aging. I'm still aging. But because my cellular health is high, my healing capacity is high, so I just don't need other things as much. So I know it's a little bit roundabout, but I think anybody can benefit from any particular quantity of herbs, especially these things that I define in the book as these everyday herbs.
I was going to ask you to make that distinction, because the ones that you are recommending for every day have a different toxicity profile than certain other herbs. And how can a person decide, for example, if a person walks into any store where there are herbal supplements, some may have potential for toxicity if they took too much versus others, you know, because sometimes we see a bump in liver function tests or some abnormality that says their body may not be doing well. How could a person find which ones are ones that are on the safer end and which ones that they should be using with caution?
Yeah, I put a chart inside the book of herbs that are in the green zone, and then yellow zone would be some of the ones you're mentioning. And then red zone is more things you really should stay away from completely, and they're more drug-like. If I have an herb that has really strong drug-like properties, most of the time I would elect to use a drug because I can control the dose of that potentially toxic thing better. But yellow zone herbs would be herbs that people would take to relieve a specific symptom. And it happens to be because of the chemical messenger phytochemicals in that plant, it may have a physiologic effect that's similar to a drug. So a very good example would be St. John's wort. St. John's wort is not an herb that I use very much myself or in my practice. It's a great herb. I mean, it really does have some wonderful properties, but it has basically the same kind of chemical that you would find in the drugs Prozac or Zoloft. It has chemicals that affect reuptake of serotonin, so you build up more serotonin. But because of those more drug-like effects, it can affect the doses of other drugs and liver function and that sort of thing. So I typically, you know, if you're using an herb just to treat a symptom, you're going to find that you're going to have more, you know, drug interactions and that sort of thing. If you're using an herb just to promote your health, then that is going to have less potential to interact with drugs or cause any kind of problems. And fortunately, there are a lot of herbs that fall in that category of what I would call the everyday herbs. But it is interesting, even St. John's wort has a complex chemistry beyond that chemical that's blocking serotonin reuptake. So Prozac or Zoloft, you get that drug-like effect, and that's it. So if you take Prozac or St. John's wort instead, you not only get that effect, but you do still get all the other protective effects. It has the antimicrobial properties. It's protecting cells. So you're still getting more out of that herb than you would strictly a drug.
And for consumers who want to incorporate herbs, how do they differentiate which ones to take for what condition, which ones are safer ones, which ones can be medicinal? Obviously, get your book. It sounds, you know, great resource. Is there another way, or how would you recommend people go about just deciding what to take, because there's just so much, and you've of course spent over a decade studying and analyzing these.
Well, there's great information in the book. I do a lot of writing and putting information out there. One of the reasons we created a company is just because I found so many substandard products. The way that most supplement companies go about creating products is to look for a pain point that people are trying to solve that would prefer to use an herb rather than a drug. And they create a product that at least has that ingredient in it, but often at a substandard dose, put a lot of marketing hype behind it. And basically, you can use anything, including water, to create a pre-placebo effect enough to get testimonials. And unfortunately, that's the messy part of the supplement industry. There are a lot of substandard products out there. So that is a big reason why I wrote the book, is because I'm such a big advocate of herbs and I want people to use them, but I also want them to make choices. So, but there are a lot of categories of herbs that you can look at. So people are starting to hear about a class of herbs that we call adaptogens. And there are a lot of adaptogens. Rhodiola is one of my favorite adaptogens. But there are some adaptogens that aren't necessarily plants. Our medicinal mushrooms are used in modern herbology also. So reishi and cordyceps are wonderful adaptogens. You hear a lot about ginseng. That's a nice adaptogen. I don't use it that much because it's pretty stimulating. And I don't like to do things that might disrupt people's sleep, which it has the potential to do. A lot of people have found the value of ashwagandha, which has this wonderful balancing effect. So an adaptogen is an herb that by definition does not have drug-like properties, has only protective effects. But what defines an adaptogen is it balances stress hormones. So that's a difference between an herb like rhodiola or ashwagandha, which is defined as an adaptogen, and herbs like turmeric or hawthorn. So turmeric, everybody knows that one. It's the yellow color of an Indian curry, and it has wonderful anti-inflammatory effects. It also has antimicrobial effects and all kinds of other cell protective effects. That's how it works. But it doesn't really balance stress hormones, so it's not considered an adaptogen. But it's still an everyday herb in my book. Hawthorn is another one that is really good for the heart and vascular system. But I don't define it as an adaptogen, or most people don't define it as an adaptogen, because it's not balancing stress hormones. But staying within those categories, there are plenty of choices. And what I tell people is choose half dozen or a dozen herbs and start taking them. I will add, though, it's not only important to get a good phytochemical concentration in the product, but blends are important. And that's something that we've recognized in herbology since the beginning of time, is you get a lot more benefit when several herbs are blended together. So typically when 5 to 12 herbs are blended, you get a stronger effect than you would from each of the individual herbs. And it's because every plant's chemistry is a little bit different, and the protective properties that plant brings depends on the environment and the stress factors within the plant's natural environment.
For people who are interested in doing a blend, are there top herbs that you recommend?
Oh, I always have my list. You know, and so the blend that I put together for people to use on a daily basis, I look at, well, you know, some herbs are maybe a little better for protecting some cell types in the body, and we want to bring in some adaptogens. So rhodiola is one of my favorite adaptogens, so I always put that in the blend. Rhodiola is from Siberia, cold, harsh environment, so it has to deal with all those physical stress factors. And that's what it helps us with. It helps us deal with physical stress. But interestingly, you find relatives of plants all around the world. And I found that no matter what herbal discipline, you'll find different plants around the world in different places that are similar. So we actually have a very close relative of rhodiola that grows in the Appalachian Mountains of North America. So you find that similar plant. It also grows around Alaska and Canada. So it's not exclusive to Siberia. Reishi mushroom is a favorite. If you take a walk in the woods and you see a fan mushroom on the side of a tree with kind of a rust rainbow color, that's a reishi. So there are different species of reishi all around the world. The Asian species has been studied in Japan and found to have some of the most potent anti-cancer substances on the planet. It's a great immune balancer, what we call an immune modulator. It has some antiviral properties and other antimicrobial properties. Turmeric, always put that on the list. Wonderful anti-inflammatory. Another favorite is Gotu Kola, which is really good for the brain. Native to India, I found out recently, they have actually found it growing on the coast of South Carolina. Wow. And we don't know whether it was implanted there or whether it's just a really close relative. Again, we find things all around the world. So that's covering a lot of bases. That's covering your vascular system and a lot of other things baseline. But I always add in milk thistle. Milk thistle is an herb that protects the liver. So in our modern world, we are just bombarded with toxins. And some of the part of how, why we become ill as we age is we lose liver function. We burn out our liver cells. 25% of the population has fatty liver. So they found that milk thistle actually stimulates regeneration of liver cells. So that's very important. French maritime pine bark, great for the vascular system. Hawthorn for the heart. Add those things together. That's a pretty nice spectrum of coverage.
Bill, for people who are looking for resources, what are resources you recommend? How can they learn more about your work and just about some of the information that you just shared today?
Well, I do a lot of writing because these topics interest me so much. So books, I'm trying to become more active on social media to get some of these concepts out there. I have a lot of blogs and both on our site and others floating around. And there are other physicians. Most of your functional medicine doctors are coming around to herbs. It's taking them a long time to do that. Naturopaths, herbs are pretty natural to them, so they're going to include herbs and herbology in general. So you're starting to see a lot more herbal products. And so I think we're going to be hearing about the true value of this thing more and more. But I'll have to say this unique take of looking at what the herbal phytochemicals are doing at the cellular and biochemical level, I'm not seeing that much of that out there. People don't necessarily think that way. So the things that I'm having to say are somewhat novel, but I'm getting a lot of traction. I think people are starting to pay attention.
That's great. And we'll attach your website as well as your social media to the show notes. So for people who are interested, they can learn more. And people have questions or any ideas that they want us to share, you can also reach me at Instagram, Dr. Sharon Berquist. I'm always open to hearing from our listeners. So Dr. Rawls, thank you so much. All the information you provided is so helpful. And I think, like you said, the way you're really putting in context mechanistically, like at a cellular level, what we're doing and how important that is, really valuable. And it is a little different. And it really explains things, like you said, in a framework that helps people understand exactly the power and the function of what the herbs are doing. So thank you so much for all your work.
Oh, well, thank you for giving me this opportunity to share it.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode and share it with a friend. Until next time, do something to help improve your whole health naturally.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of any entities they represent.